Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg, is entitled Teacher-Student Relationship in Buddhism. We can sense the presence of Buddha nature in a spiritual friend, our Lama. To the degree that we can have a felt sense of the presence of Buddha, we can begin to have faith in our own Buddha nature and the Buddha nature in others. Our Lama invites us into the practice of aspiring, nurturing, strengthening, and engendering kindness and compassion. The path the Lama points out and helps us to progress upon becomes our path, a path worthy of having faith in. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So, I'm sure all of you know that the founder of our center and truly a beloved teacher, and in my mind one of the living Buddhas in this world, checked out of his fleshly motel last Saturday. And today, actually, they're doing the ritual cremation up at his home, the three-year retreat in Delhi, New York, called Karma Ling. So that's happening right now while we're doing this. And Lama Kathy asked me if I would give this talk, because there's a lot of people that are up there, and I was going to be here, so I said, sure, and what should I talk about? And she said, well, it'd be appropriate to talk about the Lama in this tradition, what the Lama is, and the Guru. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. I will say this, that Kempo Carthar had a wonderful and long life. There's a good biography of him if you're interested in reading. It's worth reading. On the KTD website, I think it's kaju.org or kaju.com, one of them. And or if you just look up Google biography of Kempo Carthar Rinpoche, it'll come up. He was an extraordinary man in this sense that while we in this tradition have reincarnate lamas, you know, people who achieve liberation and then come back for the benefit of beings, because they've totally transformed their mind to wanting liberation for everybody. So they keep helping until there's nobody left to help. It's said that Kempo Carthar Rinpoche actually achieved liberation during this lifetime, which is a very rare thing. I've seen that, actually heard that from two reliable sources. One was Trungpa Rinpoche, and the other was from Karmapa, who he would never claim it himself. It was one of the things about him that seemed so extraordinary to me. He was extraordinarily modest and humble and powerful all at the same time. He could have been the rock star Lama of North America. I mean, the 16th Karmapa installed him as the abbot of the monastery that was built as his seat in North America. In other words, he's kind of like the king of the Western Hemisphere. And he just never bid on that identity thing, which to me seems like an indication of his actual realization. So So this talk is just kind of came together. I just started writing and notes flowed, and it's really not about him. This is it's just about the idea of what a lama is in Vajrayana Buddhism, and particularly in Vajrayana Buddhism. Of course, there are teachers, and that work for the benefit of beings in the Theravadan tradition, in the Mahayana traditions of Zen and so on, and the Vajrayana tradition. And they're all a little bit different. So this talk is specifically about that, because it's, I think, misunderstood, and right now it is something that needs to be understood better. Let me just say that everything that's here is basically because of Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche. He was an exemplar of what I have to say here. Before I get launched into that, I also want to say that our Dharma brothers in the prison at Chillicothe finally got something that we've been working on for 6 years, which is we had an all-day long meditation retreat last Thursday. And it was an extraordinary experience. Chuck was there. Jim Dunn was there. And, you know, all morning we went as deeply as we could get into shamatha meditation, calm abiding meditation, with periods of teaching, periods of sitting, periods of walking, periods of teaching, and so on and so forth. And we asked them to maintain sacred silence, which was a very interesting experience, because the one thing that there's a poverty of in prison is a poverty of silence. They were so grateful for that. I mean, after the first couple of minutes of just reminding them not to talk, they wouldn't even talk when we told them they could.
Where did you find a quiet place?
There was a multi-purpose room in the chapel building, the religious services building. And
nobody else around?
They just... The younger chaplain is really, I think, interested in helping us. So they didn't schedule anything in there except for the early service in the Protestant chapel, which was done by 9:30. So we had the run of the place. We had calm abiding meditation and teachings about that in the morning, and a break for lunch, and then the short Chen Reisi practice in the afternoon, teachings about that and practice. And then finally, at the very end of the day, for the last 50 minutes or so, chance for Q&A where they could talk. The one other exception to that was they could talk during the day. We were able, because Chuck came, to have individual interviews for each guy, where they could just go in and talk one-on-one, and Jim Dunn handled that.
There
were 13 of them and three of us. The requirement was that they had to be declared as Buddhists on their little form that they have with the prison. It wasn't for general population in everybody, because frankly, we were bringing food in, and we would have had the whole prison in there. One of the guys did remark in his one-on-one time, apparently, that it was the best food he'd had in 5 years, which is totally true. There's no doubt about that.
Not saying much, but.
Right. Well, you know, it was actually pretty decent. It was from Panera, and that was good. They wanted to extend their deepest gratitude to this whole community. We donated money, which came from dues and donations that all of you have paid and made in order to get sets of cushions for them to sit on. We never had those before either. We just got them, and we got 12 sets. And so their gratitude is overflowing, and it's different this time. Let's just mentally dedicate the merit of participating in the liberation of people who are truly in actual physical jail, because that happened. The sense I had was that I know that Kempo Kartha Rinpoche was lying in state, in a sense, up at Karma Ling, but he was really with us. I felt him there. I felt Karmapa there. I know for a fact that Karmapa is aware of what we're doing in prison. He cares about that. And so, you know, without all of you literally supporting this, that couldn't happen. It really couldn't. So just take a moment and reflect on that and dedicate the merit to the liberation of all beings. Thank you. So as usual, let's start with chanting the four-line refuge prayer together. Particularly in this case, for this talk, it would be good to each time that we go through it, each of the three times, first, you know, think about you as a material person in this material world, and bringing liberation to that. And the second time, think about you as a relational person, connected with everything, the way you relate, and bring liberation to that. And the third time, you as literally the light in the spaciousness of your life, bringing warmth and clarity, and take refuge in that. Sanjay Judong Suki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dakni Kyab Su Chi Daki Jin So Ji Pe Sunam Ki Drula Penchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Judang So Ki Chok Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dakni Kyab Su Chi Daki jinso yipe sunaki drola penchir sanje druparsho sanje chudang soki chognam la jangchu pardu dakni kyatsuchi daki jinso yipe sunamki Drola Penchir Sanje Drupa Shom. One of the quintessential guru-student relationships, in fact, the seminal one for this lineage, is relationship between Talopa and Naropa. So I have a few Talopa quotes in here. I decided to go right to the source. And the first quote from Talopa is, wishing to attain liberation from intolerable suffering, rely upon a wise guru. When the guru's blessings enter your heart, your mind will be liberated. These things of samsara are meaningless and pointless. The causes of suffering. And since all these things that have been done or made are pointless. Look at that which is. The first part of this is understanding why we would even enter this kind of Buddhist path, this Vajrayana path, and upon entering it, why we would pray for a teacher. It's emphasized a lot, and I want to say ahead of time, you know, there, you'll hear today and you'll hear from a lot of people that you need a teacher, and we as Americans, since we're used to going out and, you know, a few clicks on the computer and getting to Amazon and buying what we want, and there it is, boom. Finding a teacher isn't like that, actually, and it can come in a lot of different forms. And we need to take our time, and we have some responsibilities to test the relationship and make sure it's a good one. When we do find them, you might kiss a few frogs before you find a prince, I'm telling you. And you may meet your teacher and not recognize it right away. You may meet your teacher and want to test it for yourself before you make that commitment, because it opens up a lot of things. I can tell you, I met Kenpo Carther Rinpoche years before I asked him to be my teacher. You know, there was a moment when I recognized it. You know, from his point of view, I think he knew all along, and he sort of looked at me and said, "What took you so long?" But it really doesn't matter. It took me as long as it took me to be confident. One of the first teachings is that we might think that we have to get somewhere else to reach a state beyond suffering. We have this wondering, you know, how could this world that we're in be the place that we seek? It causes us literally no end of grief. That was the first noble truth, right? This life contains suffering. And in the Vajrayana, what the teaching is, well, guess what? This place is actually nirvana. Nirvana and samsara are the same place. It's only suffering because we think we get it. And we cling fast to the thought that we get it when we don't get it at all. And that's ignorance. And as we all know, ignorance is the chief mental poison that creates our suffering. The flip side of ignorance is wisdom. Buddha taught, this is from the sutras, that the realms beyond, he never denied that there are realms beyond, like what people call heaven and stuff like that. He called them the formless realms. He also said they are definitely not nirvana, which is kind of interesting, right? It's like, yeah, they're there, but they're also, you're not getting it. They're not what you think they are either. In fact, he never really named a place, like a location for nirvana. He didn't say like, oh yeah, it's like the seventh heaven, or it's like a hidden land beyond that mountain over there, or something like that. He didn't say it was the Magic Kingdom. Sorry, Walt Disney. Although there are some great pictures of the 16th Karmapa and the 17th visiting Disneyland and playing around with Mickey Mouse and all those guys. Yeah, they're hilarious. They're fun. One of the things I've heard from scholars and read over the years is that since I don't read Pali or Sanskrit or anything, I just rely on them. Apparently, the Buddha never called nirvana nirvana. He called, in the original language, it was always called the city of nirvana. which is really an interesting thing. We just shortened it to Nirvana, but it's the city of Nirvana. If you think of a city, it's an interdependent relational place. In a sense, when what he's saying is when you wake up and all of a sudden you're like skillful in relationships and your motivations are purified, you'll experience bliss. That's where you'll experience it, in this direct realization of interdependence. What's that? Yeah. I thought that too, but I'm pretty sure it was C-I-T-Y. Oh. Not the city like power. The city like the city of Columbus.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Isn't that weird? Except if you think about it, that's the point. It's about, there was a Zen master. Jim Dunn says this all the time, so I don't remember which Zen master, but I remember the quote. So I guess I'm quoting Jim Dunn. He said that at the end of a long life of meditation, this master was asked what he learned. And in beautiful Zen fashion, he gave a three-word answer. He said, an appropriate response. You think about that. If Nirvana is really the city of Nirvana, that is like perfect. It's really interesting. So the Buddha wasn't revealing like an escape hatch from all of this, you know, like, oh, there's an escape hatch over here. What he revealed was that there's a door into ourselves. Right in the here and now. It exists right in this moment. And it's beyond, it's to a place within ourselves that's beyond our habitual tendencies and all the noise of our preferences and afflictive emotions. In introducing it that way, he also said, you know, somebody's got, we're pretty obscured. Somebody's got to point out the fact that there is a door there. And then they have to probably help us open the door because it's probably rusted shut with all the crap and corruption that, you know, we have from our clinging minds. And so the Buddha began to talk about something. This is also interesting, something different from what the Vedic practitioners called guru. We use the word guru and lama interchangeably, but he really made a distinction. The idea of a guru in the Vedic tradition is something heavy and weighty above your head, something that you really have to knuckle under for. The Buddha kind of rejected that. He didn't feel that a door and a path and skillful means could be pointed out by something heavy and domineering like that. And that makes sense psychologically in a lot of ways. What he said is, what we need is a skillful spiritual friend. And that's what a lama is, a skillful spiritual friend. So lama in Sanskrit translates to the word anatara, which is also one of the yogas of the Vajrayana. Anatara simply means unsurpassed. In other words, they are a perfect, unsurpassed reflection of what you yourself, what your higher self is. So a lama is a teacher, a skillful teacher, and virtuous friend, and you can see something like my reaction to Kenpo Rinpoche when I first saw him, even though I didn't, you know, leap to feeling like I should ask him that to be my teacher. I can say the first reaction I had to him was, I want to be like that when I grow up. For me, right away, I saw that he was unsurpassed. That's, you know, he was like an ultimate goal kind of person. Because of that, in the Vajrayana, we do some things like their ceremonies that are very, very skillfully put together that are introduced to us in order to help us do things like find the door and find the path and walk the path. And just repeating the words after the Lama, since he's our friend and he's unsurpassed, just that can be a real blessing if we have the attitude necessary for receiving a blessing. And that attitude is actually always taught right away, which is we want to receive this in order to free ourselves from the things that cause us to have inappropriate responses in life and get in our way, the ways we get in our own way, and that we want to do this not only for ourselves and for others. That's the right attitude. If we have that attitude, just by following along with a lama, a qualified, skillful, spiritual friend, we can receive a blessing. Or by doing the same thing in a slightly more developed way, if we've begun the path of really consistently practicing calm abiding meditation so that we cultivate a mind that lets go, which is what that is. If we've taken our bodhicitta commitments seriously, which is the desire to wake up and for all beings to wake up, to literally do it for the benefit of others, we can receive the teachings of a lama, and we can repeat mantra, and we can participate in various rituals with him and receive more than just a blessing. We can receive it as a vow, as a transformational part of our life. That's what a vow is. It's something that you take on that really is transformational for your life. It's really interesting that there are certain vows, like the Bodhisattva vow, certain empowerments that you'll take over 1,000 times in your lifetime if you're lucky. You'll even see senior lamas take them multiple times in their lifetime. At one point, I gotta say, why is that? Why do this again and again? The question arose out of my ignorance because I really didn't get it, even though I thought I got it. And the truth is that we're all in a work in process. Just being a human being, even if you're a lama human being, there's still process happening. There's still evolution happening. And as we grow and as we let go, we change. So each time you take in, it deepens it. It helps you get a little further down the road in that mandala of yours till you find the center and realize your Buddha nature. I remember being at KTD a long time ago. Mindger Rinpoche was there, and Barda Rinpoche was still there. And Mindger Rinpoche, his previous one, the original Mindger Rinpoche, was like one of the geniuses of the Nyingma and the Karma Kagyu, the medicine Buddha practice we do came from him. The Karmapakshi Guru Yoga that we do came from him, and a whole bunch of other things. This Dakini script on my t-shirt came from him. This is called Liberation on Seeing. So just by seeing it, you can receive a blessing. Anyway, so the current Mindger Rinpoche was there, and he's one of the most fabulous meditation teachers I've ever met. He is just great. And he was giving the Karmapakshi empowerment. So, you know, I don't remember which one he is, but third or fifth or whatever. and seemed like a very powerful thing. And at the Q&A at the end, somebody raised their hand and asked the question about part of it. And he looked out and he said, I don't know. And I'm thinking like, well, your previous one wrote the thing, you know. And then he further commented, he said, but if you really want to know, ask Bartar Tulku Rinpoche. Because he received this directly from the 16th Karmapa. He'll be able to tell you. And it's like that. So even Mindy Rinpoche, who was giving the empowerment in a sense, also was able to take another few steps down the road. And that was because the interdependence of a student who asked a really good question. So they depend on us too. And the interdependence of somebody who had received the tradition from an authentic source. And the willingness, you know, to share all the goodness he could, even though he knew himself that it wasn't complete. It's interesting. That's one of the ways you might begin to understand the city of Nirvana. We're all in it together. We all have a role. And to the degree you can let go of the divisions and really celebrate each other's contribution, you can feel more and more bliss and relaxed happiness, a little less grabbiness and a little less need to control. There's a great Catholic priest named Richard Rohr, who I'm happy to say is an old friend of mine. I lived with Richard for like 14 years. And he says something really interesting. He says, the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is control. And when one of the things that our lineage is doing in the path of teachings that we receive is giving us really skillful means for working with our own minds, who desperately feel like if we could just control our situation, we'd feel safe and we'd feel happy and all of those kind of things. Of course, the opposite is true. That's how we create our own samsara. So this path of teachings is to help us cultivate a mind that lets go of this control. And so one of the things that the Lama does for us is to train us to let go of what needs to be let go of. And at the same time, more deeply experience that which actually is fundamental and true, which is this kind of luminous clarity, this Buddha nature that's already resident within all of us. That's the whole point of that city of Nirvana again. You don't go somewhere else to get it. You don't do magic tricks to get it. It's already here, it's just obscured. And so all these practices are to help us skillfully learn how to clear away our own obscurations. And it requires patience and kindness and all kinds of qualities that help us also learn how to treat each other with respect and with great wisdom. So it all works together. Another quote from Tilopa. The fool in his ignorance, disdaining Mahamudra, knows nothing but struggle in the flood of samsara. Have compassion for those who suffer constant anxiety. Sick of unrelenting pain and desiring release, adhere to a master. For when his blessing touches your heart, the mind is liberated. There are many ways that a master works, but one of the main ways is through this initiation process. And to understand that well, we call it empowerment. I remember when I first heard the word empowerment, I was like thrilled. And I said to myself, oh, I want that. Empowerment? You bet I want that. What do I need to do to get that? And I did. It was kind of crazy. What empowerment is it takes us to the door. It shows us the door to this mandala that's our life, that our true nature, our Buddha nature, sits in the center of. And then it also creates this cognitive dissonance, which is really, really interesting, because there's a dissonance between the unreality of the person that I cling to, this made-up self, this story I tell myself about myself, and what the Lama sees. Because what the Lama sees when he looks at us is our Buddha potential. I can remember Kempo Kartha Rinpoche here in Columbus looking, just stopping what he was saying once and looking out at all of us, had tears in his eyes, and he just said, if you could only see what I see. At which point, Lama Yeshe Jamso was translating for him, had tears in his eyes too, and pretty soon we all had tears in our eyes. In the initiation, you have different stages. So you enter the mandala through a door that's been pointed out, and you've opened in your own mind. And then by the time you get to the fourth empowerment, what's called the fourth empowerment, the Lama says, you're the Buddha. That's the fourth empowerment. It's like all the juice comes at once and it's like, boom, there it is. You're the Buddha. But you know what? I've gone to a lot of empowerments where I didn't feel like the Buddha. I still don't think I was acting like the Buddha. Sometimes I feel a little different, a little unusual, catch a little buzz, you know, the energy is kind of an experience, the rush of the energy. But sometimes that doesn't happen either. So sometimes you don't feel different at all. Regardless of what you feel, you say, but Buddha? Really? Really? And so what I wrote here, which I think is invaluable to me at least, is you don't see the Lama bestowing the initiation as Buddha or indivisible with Buddha, but that is what you're supposed to see. We don't see it because we're still attached to our obscurations. We're a work in progress. So we engage our imagination, and that's where this whole thing in Vajrayana about using our imagination goes. It's like, okay, we might not directly experience it, but we can imagine it. Some of us will have a kind of vision based on previous experience, even experience in previous lives, imprinted on our mind streams, and it'll feel unfamiliar. Regardless, well, it'll feel familiar in that case, or it might feel unfamiliar. Regardless, we just need to start from wherever we are and work at it. The work itself is the practice the Lama gives us to do. It processes us, it cleanses our obscurations, it strengthens us, and it builds resources we need for our journey. Vajrayana practices are brilliant treasures in that way. The only way to learn them is from a spiritual friend. Since we're all obscured by the stories we tell ourselves, we need the fair witness of a spiritual friend. The problem is that we'll take these things because, you know, like I said, I first heard the word empowerment. I wanted empowerment. It was just like me wanting another ego trip, protecting myself from my fear and vulnerability and all that kind of jazz. It's kind of going the opposite way. Spiritual friends have a way of being able to see that and ask just the right question or make just the right statement that stops us in our tracks and makes us think and helps us to contemplate deeper and break through that obscuration. Without it, we could just take something very powerful and co-opt it and make it a part of our own ego and become a megalomaniac rather than an enlightened being. This happens. You read about it. When you read about troubling things in Dharma world, particularly in Vajrayana, it's usually something like that that has happened. It's important that you have this, like, I want to be like him when I grow up, you know, sense the presence of the Buddha nature in a spiritual friend. That's why you have to test them. You really have to see it. Because ultimately, that's going to be a reflection of what you've got in yourself. And so that's why they say devotion, and devotion being actually a clear reflection, a loving reflection of what or who is in front of you in your own heart. It's like that intimate of a connection. Devotion's a whole other talk. But we use that word without really understanding it very well. Just think of it, though, that the spiritual friend has to engender the qualities of a Buddha for you. And that gives you a chance as you go through the process of practice to cleanse the mirror enough to begin to reflect that yourself. A lot of times when we see Lama Kathy and how wonderful she is, she will tell you a lot of that is she's just getting clearer and clearer as a reflection of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. That's actually how it's supposed to work. And that's why in some texts it even says that your Lama, your teacher, is more precious than the Buddha himself. Because as human beings, we need that. That's what we need. The Lama gives us a point of view. He initiates us into the mandala, opens a door for us, and helps us to find the path. And by walking it away of being at home in the universe. And that's what we're really all looking for, is just finding a way that we're at home in the universe. We feel so much like alienated beings. Individual, you know, America built on rugged individualism, celebrating that, gets us in trouble because it's not reality. We're all interconnected. We just don't know a skillful way to work with it. We don't even know how to see it. We don't know how to perceive it. That's the Lama's job, is to point the way for us. The practices that we're given help, you know, even when we don't understand them, and I can absolutely say this is true for me. Kempo Rinpoche would say, do this or do that practice. And I would like, what? That makes no sense. How is that going to help me? Well, of course I can't see it. If I could see it, I would know already. And, you know, I don't see it because I don't see it. So in a sense, having faith is letting go of that control so that I can experience what he sees I have potential to experience. And sure enough, these practices, I can tell you from a lot of experience now, are extremely beautifully crafted and skillful and help us to have our own direct experience of our own Buddha nature. And again, to the point where we wake up and say, oh yeah, that's it. And that's the point. That is brings another point. That's the basis for the urging we get to maintain a sacred view towards our teacher. Sacred view meaning that what they do, we regard as the activity of a Buddha. We, of course, get into trouble when we have magical thinking about that. If we lose our bodhicitta for a minute and think it becomes transactional, and if I give the teacher this, I'll get that. Not so good things can happen. And again, you can read about them, but usually that's the dynamic that's going on. From the student's side, they lose their sense of responsibility for cultivating a mind that lets go, and a sense of responsibility for bodhicitta, and decide that, oh, I can get really close to the Lama, I can get really intimate, and I can get special blessings, I can get this for me, 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 and that's not sacred view. And that's how abuses actually can happen. Because it's a city of nirvana, it's a relationship that has to be healthy. It's a relationship that has to be reflective with clarity. It's not a magical person going to bonk you on the head with a special scepter and all of a sudden you're going to feel better and not be vulnerable in your life and all that kind of stuff. That's not what's going on. I had to say that simply because there's so much disturbing stuff that you, if you're looking around, you'll read about abuses even among great teachers that we follow. There's problems on the teacher side too when that happens. There are. But we as students, you know, we have some responsibility. And if that relationship isn't right, we got to name that and say, this isn't right. And then see where that leads. Just like as citizens of this city or this country, we have to know stuff in order to vote. And if we just vote out of our reactions and preferences, we could get a bad result. It's good to know stuff. Here's what I wrote down. From the student side, in order to practice the Lama's instructions, you need to have generated the aspiration to engender the bodhisattva mind. Actively contemplate that your attractions, aversions, and illusory narratives about this and that are not worthy of your faith and efforts. Life is too short and fragile to waste that way. You need to have begun the path of meditation, cultivating a mind that lets go, cultivating calm abiding and spacious awareness. It seems like a lot of work. Why bother? Buddha taught that wisdom is the antidote for suffering. If we gain wisdom, which is knowledge of reality, we become blissfully free of suffering. Our illusion is that we are being an alienated being in the middle of a difficult universe, being bruised and banged up from all sides. That's our delusion. That world is not real. It's a story we tell ourselves about experience. When we let go of that story, we discover things as they are, interdependent, like a mandala, not alienated. And we are the Buddha of the mandala. We become free of any enmity. free of any enmity and worthy of honor. If you look at the translation of the Sanskrit for arhat, which are the enlightened ones, the exact translation is free of enmity and worthy of honor. Our relationship with Lama will loosen the grip on our self-centered identity enough that we can carry the view of the mandala in balance with relative reality and begin to take responsibility for shaping our relative reality in the mandala of loving kindness and compassion, skillfully responding to whatever is up for you. Your friend, your Lama, can help so much with this. So, last quote from Talopa regarding this, and my favorite Talopa quote. Naropa came with, Naropa had a lot of complaints at one point, a lot of problems. I don't know if you know about him. He was like really, really, he was the rock star Lama at Nalanda. He was highly regarded professor of great Buddhist university, you know, kind of like, oh, I don't know, the Jeremy Siegel of the Wharton School or something like that, you know. And he realized that he'd gotten as far as he could go, and he still was far from what the Buddha taught and the things that he was teaching. So he went and found Talopa, who didn't look like much. And that's another story for another time, too. And Talopa, hearing all his problems and complaints, said, "Oh, my son," which in itself is just a great thing. That's the way it is for a Lama. They look at us like they're children. "Oh, my son, appearances of phenomena do not bind you to samsara, but attachment to them does." So Naropa cut off attachment. So that's my talk on gurus and lamas and so on and so forth. The question mic is open. If you have questions, comments, a story about Kempo Kartha Rinpoche you'd like to tell, or anything else, please feel free. Hi, Arvin.
Hey, Eric. So ending your talk on pretty much the fourth thought is pretty good.
Thank you.
Without getting the reading empowerment or the empowerment for it, I mean, I guess it wasn't a big deal, but, you know, I was inspired by Lama Kathy because I was texting her mm-hmm. while she was getting the Mountain Dharma reading transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm in a Buddhist monastery with a library full of books. And, you know, I pull out, I think it was second volume of Mountain Dharma, and started reading it. This is actually a couple days before Kempo Kartha died.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I mean, I didn't know.
Right.
You know.
About a week before, right?
Yeah. It was, and I'm reading, I got started reading it before I was told, hey, you don't have the reading empowerment for that. Maybe you need to put that down. But I was reading the introduction and the preface and all that. And, you know, I had this profound, I don't know what you want to call it, real just understanding, like, you know, reading that and reading Kempo Kartha's, you know, commentary on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, wow, like I wouldn't be here in this monastery if it wasn't for him.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, I think if I remember what it was, he made some reference to what he went through to get over those mountains
mm-hmm.
and get out of Tibet and what he went through. And it was like, someone just took a Vajra and just jammed it into my skull. That's what it felt like. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. I was like, wow. Like I would not, be in this monastery. I would not have spent the last 17 years here.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, whoa. So I would not have gotten all the teachings I've gotten and doing all the practices I'm doing. I would not have cultivated, still working on it, work in progress,
mm-hmm.
cultivating that mind of letting go. So that's, I guess, my comment. There is a question I have, because as we were talking before, I am going through the Torch of Certainty again, mm-hmm. and that chapter on Guru Yoga, and you were talking about naming abuses of,
mm-hmm.
you know, our lamas, our teachers. And, you know, in that book, it's pretty, at least I may have not a very good understanding of it or insight onto it, but it seems pretty clear. Like, you know, it says, from my recollection, you know, it talks about, like, you know, do not criticize the lama or the guru.
Mm-hmm.
Do not, you know, if they are committing abuses, no matter what it is, whatever it might seem, look at it as a teaching,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that kind of thing. And so I would, if you have any commentary on that discernment between what you're talking about in your teaching and what's in that text, I'd be interested in hearing that.
Yeah, I think that text is very, very dense and pithy.
Yeah.
And they don't waste a lot of words there.
Nope.
That's one of the reasons that it's good to get a reading transmission. You know, empowerment reading transmission and teachings on a subject. It's not, once again, just a magical formula. It's really helpful because you're dealing with the whole, your imagination and what the imagination should be in the Wang. The reading transmission is just a way of really relaxing into it and receiving it as a blessing, purely as a blessing,
right.
without getting all cognitive. But the tree, the explanation, is really important. And I think that's one of the things you're asking for here. I'm not necessarily fully qualified, but I'll tell you what I think.
That's all I'm asking.
One of the reasons why I emphasized being careful with establishing a relationship and making sure it's a really good one is because you know, there are texts that say you should, before you ask somebody to be your teacher, you should test them. And there's actually lists of tests that you should put them through.
Do you know where I can find that?
You know, not off the top of my head, but I'll tell you what, if I can lay my hands on it, I will send it to you.
That works.
And that's something that, because of our acquisitiveness as a culture, we kind of skip over that part. It's kind of like saying wanting to drive a car without getting driver's training,
mm-hmm.
or something like that, or fly a plane without flight training.
Right.
Vajrayana is very powerful. And, you know, for people who are going to drive or fly, there are responsibilities on both sides, not just on the manufacturer's side, right?
Right.
And I think we need to take that seriously, really. And if we don't, yeah, you can get into some crashes, but you can say that crashes are crashes. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then look deeply. It's like, what was I looking for? What did I learn? Okay, that's a teaching. What did I learn?
Mm-hmm.
Where did I lose my bodhicitta and go for the grabbiness?
Right.
You know, I'm not saying that abuse doesn't happen, but I'm also saying that it can, sure, it can be a teaching, and it can be indicative that you really haven't found your spiritual friend yet.
Right.
There's nothing there that says you can't move on. If you cultivate a mind that lets go, what you lose is your enmity.
Your what?
Enmity is the word the Buddha used. It means this mind that's oppositional.
Got it.
you lose the oppositional part of the reactivity of your mind. And so you can say thank you and back out of the room with a bow, as you're supposed to, and go to find your teacher. Mm-hmm. If there's abuse there, sure, there's plenty to learn. Mm-hmm. And you have to take responsibility for seeing it. You don't have to engender enmity in order to do that.
Just a guess here, too. I wonder if it's partly a caution against once you're in a relationship with your teacher, that you don't back off just because they turn out to be imperfect. So at a certain point, once you enter the relationship, you may test it, but then you're in.
Right.
And you've got to be careful about then, you know, backing off, sabotaging, because there are some issues that come up, there are imperfections, there are things they say or do, you know, you know what I'm saying.
Well,
so I wonder if that's the other side of it. I think it's a delicate bit.
It is. Well, what Paul's saying, I'm just saying this for the tape, is that backing out just because you're unhappy or something is rubbing you the wrong way, or something that is said knocking your rough edges around a little bit, and rather than smoothing them off, you want to get out of there because you're angry or reactive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a caution against that, and you're exactly right. But there's a difference. Abuse does happen, and that's where discriminating wisdom comes in. Abuse has to be handled differently. It has to stop, and you have to stop it. Mm-hmm. And you'll be vulnerable because you were the student.
Right.
But still, that's the way it is.
Right.
And so if you're just pissed off, or if you've been challenged and you don't like it, or if somebody, which...
That's never happened to me.
Yeah, well, it has to me.
Yeah, like, I know.
I mean, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, right. But that's another story. So, that's no reason. In fact, that's a reason, if you find this big reaction in yourself, that's not a reason to back out. That's a reason to go deeper.
Right.
To really, and there's a whole method of meditation with inquiry that's important, and that's some of the richest stuff you can get.
Absolutely.
And the best teachers are going to piss you off.
Absolutely.
Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche was no pussycat with me, I'll tell you that. He's the sweetest guy in the world in the pictures. Holy moly.
Right.
I mean, you know, I got to tell you that Tilopa whacked Naropa across the face with his sandal once. It's like, bam, wake up. And that wasn't actually particularly abusive. That's what he needed. It was just like a parent and a child. Sometimes when my grandfather used to say, a klopten tuchus a gaden cup, you hit him in the ass and it goes right to the head. Children need that. We're children. Yeah, no, it's not. I think it's Yiddish. But abuse, I think you were asking about abuse, you know, some of the things that we've heard. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be named. And we have to use that to strengthen ourselves against our own reactivity, mm-hmm, and our own enmity, because that's the enemy, literally, of our enlightenment.
Right.
But discriminating wisdom is, what is it? What are you discriminating? Not between good people and bad people. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. It's between knowing what's wholesome and knowing what's unwholesome.
Right.
Knowing what's helpful and knowing what's unhelpful.
Right.
And that's why Amitabha is a big deal in terms of that particular wisdom.
How so?
Discriminating wisdom.
Oh,
that's right. What we as humans really, really need the most.
Right.
So all I'm saying is okay, this abuse happens, reactivity happens, work on your own reactivity when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No matter what happens,
right,
whether it's abuse or just discomfort or
right,
whatever.
Right. That's the.
But if it's abusive, bow and back out of the room.
Right.
And realize that, no, okay, this is my ultimate teacher.
Right.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
That's cool.
Does that make, that's just my answer to this.
Well, I think you're, you know, what you're pointing out, those distinctions between, you know, is it my reactivity, enmity, I can't enunciate.
Enmity.
Or is it abuse, you know? I mean, I was recently privy to some conversations that were going on about an associated lineage and some things that had gone in there. And someone was saying, well, you know, how do we know that they just weren't giving us a really profound teaching? Well, you know, and I remember reading in Snowline publication, there was like this, well, anything, condition of the mind can be, you know, a cause of enlightenment. Well, yeah, sure, but it's a slippery slope, you know. And so, you know, what you said there, I think, you know, kind of help, you know, flush out some discernment there.
Yeah, discernment is the key.
Right.
That's, yeah.
Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question.
A tough question, actually. I have a Lama experience.
Yeah.
I'd like to share, not directly with Kenpo Karu Rinpoche, because I haven't been able to see him for a long time. So, but I have Lama Kathy experience. So, when I first started coming to Columbus KTC, I used to kind of hide out in the back because I was a very timid person. Still am, but. So I was hiding out for like, I don't know, 3-4 months and make sure nobody notices me, not even the other Sangha people. So one day I was sitting there and ready to leave, and Lama Kathy was teaching it. She saw me and she started walking toward me. I was scared. And she came to me and she treated me like I'm her old friend, like she,
yeah.
She just saw me in like 10 years or something, and it really moved me. And I was so moved. I said, I wish I could be just like her.
Yeah.
Actually, I just thought of that. I wish I could treat everybody like they're my best friend, even though I never saw them in my whole life, because I don't think Lama Kathy ever saw me before that day. So after that, I tried to treat people, whoever that comes to Columbus KTC, especially people who hide out. I like to treat them like they're my good old friend.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Then it helped me become volunteer for greeter.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gave me a chance to say hi to the new people, because they kind of have to come through the greetings table. So at that time I didn't know much about Buddhism, but just that, I guess, loving kindness moved me so much. So that's all. And hopefully I could be nice to other people. Thank you.
That's a perfect example of how to receive a profound teaching in a profound way. I mean, really. Her greeting you like that was a profound teaching. And you actually received it, which is pretty darn cool. There are blessings everywhere all the time. Most of the time, speaking for myself, I just don't get it. You know? It's so good that you got it. Thank you. Well, I think we should close for the day. Whatever collections of virtue have been accumulated throughout the three times are dedicated in the non-objective expanse of the absolute space of phenomena. May everyone be enlightened in non-abiding primordial rest without convergence or divergence. May there be the auspiciousness of the great bliss of essential nature, of original purity, transcending the intellect. The manifest nature of great, spontaneously actualized primordial consciousness, and rain clouds showering all kinds of compassion. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.